Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Thursday morning. We're a couple days past the Pennsylvania primary and other primaries. But I don't think we have a clear sense of who the winner is going to be.
Not in the Republican Senate primary.
Right, least. Right. Democrats solve their nominee fairly readily without much fuss. When the Ohio race happened and Trump's endorsement launched J.D. Vance to victory, there's a lot of, this is Trump's party, duh. Well, how'd you possibly think otherwise? Now, it may be that Trump's going to get Oz over the finish line here, too, but it's going to be, if so, it's going to be just barely. So does this, in your mind, Matt, raise the question, how much control does Trump really have over the party?
No, I think this confirms what I've been thinking, which is that Trump is very popular in the Republican Party. And if you can get his endorsement, you probably would benefit from it. It's probably better to have his endorsement than not to have it. But it's also not definitive. I mean, it's not, it's not decisive. Donald Trump, it's not transferable. There are a lot of people who say, I love Donald Trump. I'm a huge Trump fan, but I'm going to vote for this congressman that I've known or the state representative that's been my state representative. And so Trump doesn't have the omnipotence to bestow victory on other people, even in the Republican primary.
Now, you did have Trump's endorsement in the North Carolina Senate primary go much more smoothly. You know, Ted Budd beat the former governor of North Carolina, which is very striking. I mean, Budd is just a congressman. You know, I generally have a pundit bias towards people who have won statewide before, unless they have something really negative dragging them down. They have name ID, they have donor networks, they have relationships on the ground. And in North Carolina, you know, McCrory was not like some squish Republican. This is the guy that literally did the anti-trans bathroom bill. Like, he was on the forefront of this whole issue from a conservative perspective. And somehow did not get on Trump's good side and lost handily. But in the Ohio race, J.D. Vance won with 32% of the vote. And here's Dr. Oz with 31% of the vote right now. It seems like, and we also know in Alabama, you know, Trump abandoned Mo Brooks because he wasn't getting off the ground at all. So I feel like, roughly speaking, like Trump's good for about 30% or so.
It helps. It definitely and helps.
If you have a competitive field, and you know, some people might say, hey, well, sure, Oz only got 30, but Barnett got 20, 25, and she's crazy town too. So it's still a crazy party.
Yeah.
But
there's no doubt that Trumpism has won. But, you know, Josh Krausar says Trump's record in contested May primaries is 5-3 with Oz and McCormick still pending. I think I probably put the edge to McCormick on that one, but we'll see. Mm-hmm. The fifth win, this is back to Krausar, the fifth win, the late endorsement of Mastriano, a bit of an asterisk since it came so late. Wins are Vance, Budd, Mooney, and West Virginia, Hines, Mastriano. Losses, Herbster, McGeechan, and Cawthorn. And then Krausar notes that two more losses are likely next week with Purdue losing badly and the withdrawn endorsement of Brooks in Alabama. So, look, again, there's examples of where Trump, I think Trump clearly helped Mooney here in West Virginia. I think Trump clearly made the difference, or it was a huge difference with J.D. Vance in Ohio. But, and same thing within North Carolina. But I think Trump endorsed Madison Cawthorn as well.
Yes,
and
that did, yes.
That didn't turn out the way Trump wanted.
So he did endorse Cawthorn the first time.
He endorsed his opponent the first
time.
Right. So I think, again, there are examples where I think Trump clearly is helping certain candidates, but it's not a guarantee.
So, you know, I wrote a piece at the Washington Monthly about Pennsylvania Senate. because it strikes me as a microcosm of the party itself. It's not just simply who's won or lost here, but how the whole race unfolded. You have, McCormick was someone who in 2018 encouraged people to vote for military veteran candidates, whether they were Republican or Democrat. And right after January 6th, he called it a horrific and a dark chapter in American history. And he has a record in his business career, working with China. And when he was in the Bush administration, he spoke out about trying to not go down the protectionist path, and that China and America can both win side by side. And then as a candidate, of course, he goes full MAGA, China bashes, tries to suck up to Trump, doesn't get the endorsement, of course. Oz is someone who in the Obama years, did an ad promoting Obamacare, spoke generally in favor of abortion rights, and even supported some gun control measures. And of course has flipped on all those things as a candidate. And the two of them are out there hammering each other, calling each other phonies. Oz is a secret Hollywood liberal, and McCormick's in China's pocket. And Trump himself called McCormick a liberal Wall Street Republican. Then here comes Kathy Barnett calling them both globalists.
Yeah.
And saying she won't endorse either one of them if they become the nominee. So you have a dynamic where everyone's trying to out-crazy each other. And because there's no adult supervision in this party, they're willing to tear each other down to get what they want. And now the unfavorable rating of McCormick and Oz among Republicans is quite high. In the Emerson poll that came out just before the election day, McCormick's unfavorable amongst Republicans was 32%, and Oz's was 48%. And on the Democratic side, this is a different poll. This is Franklin and Marshall College. John Fetterman's unfavorable amongst Democrats is 8%. I mean, this is a guy who, and I think it's wrong to just sort of say he's just a Bernie Sanders, just a Sanders crack. So I think he's got his own style, his own brand, his own reputation in the state. He is very left in many respects. He's single payer. He's pro-marijuana legalization. He wants to get rid of the filibuster. But he's pro-fracking. And he was needling Biden on Title 42, the immigration, Trump's immigration order. So he has calibrated himself, to fit the state in some respects. And he just, his whole style is, Western PA, born and bred, 6'8", tattooed, burly, gruff guy. And people try to let you, Democrats said, hey, this incident in 2013 where you chased down an unarmed black guy with a shotgun and detained him before police came. And that was clearly a mistake. But that didn't lay a glove on him. He won every county in Pennsylvania. So he is positioned to very quickly unify the Democratic Party, while Republicans are going to continue to beat the hell out of each other because this isn't getting resolved anytime soon. It's probably going to automatic recount, which doesn't get resolved till June 7th. And if McCormick edges ahead, thanks to late counted mail ballots, the exact way that Biden overtook Trump in Pennsylvania in 2020, people are going to lose their minds. I mean, Trump's already telling Oz, you should declare victory now, which for some reason Oz isn't. So it just seems like this is a party that's not well managed, and Trump gives incentive and encouragement to defy party authority, to go scorched earth against your own. And if that means they're going to blow a race that was winnable in Pennsylvania, I mean, it is just one Senate race, but if Democrats are going to keep the Senate, I think Pennsylvania is damn near must win. And I think they're in a pretty good place to win it right now.
Yeah, look, I think this is such an interesting race, right? So first, I think it's a microcosm of a lot of things. It's a microcosm of the Republican Party. You've just mentioned there are basically three types of Republicans now. Mm-hmm. They're all Trumpy in one way or another, right? But you've got the McCormick, who represents, he's sort of the Glenn Youngkin guy, right? He's like the executive hedge funder. He would have been a Bush Republican.
He was a Bush Republican. He's in the Bush administration.
Now he's had to become Trumpy. Like, that is a type of candidate that he represents. That's a microcosm. Then you've got Dr. Oz, which is more the celebrity model. Like, J.D. Vance, in a way, would fit into that. Mm-hmm. Vance was, I think, better at playing the populist. But that's a type of Trump candidate. And we're going to see, I think, a proliferation of that, sadly. And then you have Barnett, which is sort of like the true believer. She really is the true believer. Mm-hmm. And as we saw with Mo Brooks, who was also a true believer, ironically, it does not always work out well for them. And then we can go a little bit larger and we see Fetterman, who I think this is also a microcosm of what is happening in our politics today. I think that Connor Lamb in a different era would have been a dream candidate for Democrats. I mean, the guy looks like a Kennedy or something. Mm-hmm. And you know, moderate sort of temperament and at least record, a military background, could have been a dream candidate. He gets destroyed by this guy, Fetterman, who, you know, I think a few years ago would have been dismissed just based on his appearance. I mean, he reminds me of, like, there's a line from Raising Arizona when they're describing the villain and they got, you know, he's like, dresses like a rock star, you know, he's got the shorts and just his look is very authentic, but it's not buttoned down. It's not what you would have thought of as a proper politician look. So I think that Pennsylvania in many ways is like telling us that it represents a microcosm of the changing political landscape that we have, Bill. But to your point, look, I think the question is going to be, is the political atmosphere what matters, or do competent campaigns and organizations matter? Because I think Republicans have the wind at their back nationally and especially in Pennsylvania. I think Pennsylvania is one of those states that is trending more and more Republican for various reasons. So I think Republicans ought to win, and I think they probably will. But do campaigns matter? Does unity matter? Does it matter if everyone is on board? And if it's a really close race, then yes, those things matter at the margins. And so this, I think we don't know how Pennsylvania is going to shake out. And it very well could be that Republicans, even if Republicans do have a good midterm, which I think they will, they may not have as good. You know, we won't know what they could have done if they had gotten their act together.
Yeah, I think I largely agree with what you're saying. I do think Fetterman is his own case, because there aren't other Fettermans in the Democratic Party. You had a handful of progressive moderate primary battles on Tuesday that were kind of a split decision. It seems, though, two of the big progressive wins are still not quite settled because there's late ballots to count. That's the one Pennsylvania congressional race and the Oregon congressional race where Kirk Schrader might lose his position. But there are two other congressional House primaries in North Carolina that went the moderates' way. So there is a progressive moderate tension being played out in a lot of places. But two things I want to point out. One, there's a shift in the progressive thinking where they're really hoping to win places that are deep blue. Oregon 5, where Schrader might lose, is a case where they're playing in a swing district. And of course, it's making a lot of Democrats, you know, nervous because, you know, if Summer Lee wins in Pennsylvania, a deep blue district, you know, yeah, she's sure she's DSA, but it's so Democrat, she's going to win it if she's the nominee. The woman who might be traitor in Oregon 5 might not win it. The evidence of 2018, which was a Democratic year, was the few places where progressive beat moderates in primaries and swing areas, they lost their general elections, and the places that were blue were the places where progressives won. The flips largely came from the moderates. By and large, progressives are trying to plant their flag in places that are already blue, and they can expand their ranks that way. Fetterman is his own brand that I think some moderates are nervous about him because he's very left in a lot of respects. But I think he transcends this intra-party debate. And Democrats so desperately need more, you know, lunch pail Democrats, working class Democrats. And that's not a white thing, because, you know, Eric Adams is in that mold too.
He's one of these, what I call Ivy League populists, because I think he's a Harvard guy, I think, but.
Well, he went to the local, he grew up in West Reading, Pennsylvania. He went to the Reading, Pennsylvania College, Albright, which is where his father went. But he's a Harvard Kennedy School grad, got his master's there. And his father's wealthy, self-made, but wealthy. And when Fetterman goes back home, not home, he goes to West Pennsylvania, to Braddock, where it's not where he grew up, but it's majority black, 70% black, Pittsburgh suburb, place that was once more economically robust, steel town. He becomes mayor there. He's mayor for 13 years, wins I think, four elections. That job pays $150 a month. His dad essentially subsidizes him so he can be mayor of Braddock. So right. The people who are Fetterman critics, like, you know, this is all big phony show. But that hasn't stuck, because he was the mayor. Most people say he was a good mayor. He got reelected several times. He says, you know, crime went down on his watch. And he successfully went there to be lieutenant governor. And when this primary going away.
But how much of it, he feels authentic. I'll grant you that. Like, he does not feel, he has a populist vibe. I wonder how much of that is a product of the look, the image that he presents. Now, some of it is how physically imposing he is, but just also the way he dresses. And that's kind of what I was getting to. I think that he is representative of some trends I'm seeing in politics. First of all, the ideology, right? I mean, like, he is, you know, left wing in a sort of AOC way, or in a Bernie Sanders sort of way, that I think would not have been as sellable a few years ago. But also stylistically, like, if you turn on Fox News now, and I think Fox News knows how to do TV better than anybody, you're going to see, you know, Tucker Carlson is going to be interviewing people, and there's going to be people wearing like t-shirts, and there's going to be people with like long hair or big, you know, and some of these people are like celebrities or, you know, Duck Dynasty stars or something, but it's more casual, more dressed down. That signals to people that you're real and authentic, that you're not wearing the necktie. So I do think that there are that you know, Fetterman, yes, is unique in a way, as you said, but he also, I think, is representative of some trends that we're seeing increasingly.
Well, as far as if you have a personal brand that's not cookie cutter politician, that's to your benefit. You know, he is another example of that. You know, you might call it celebrity politics. I mean, obviously, wasn't celebrity beforehand, but he managed to build a persona, you know, before he won anything statewide, just from being mayor. He parlayed that into some national press and built a fan base.
He's basically got a Jesse the Body Ventura vibe without having been a pro wrestler / movie star.
But I don't think, I mean, he was very savvy in saying in this primary, like, I'm not there to be part of a squad. I'm here to help President Biden pass his agenda. You know, he wants to get rid of the filibuster, but he's not saying I'm going to be a thorn in the side of the party establishment.
Yeah,
which is one of the reasons why I think it was very hard for Conor Lamb to say this guy's unelectable. So I think if he wins, he's going to be an even bigger star, because again, Democrats don't have anybody on the bench.
Yeah,
they have no other Biden Democrats, no other Scranton PA Democrats on the bench who are prepared to go to working class areas and say, hey, I get where you're coming from.
If Fetterman wins, why not start talking about him as president, right?
I mean, I'm sure some people would. I think, you know, obviously I'm not a psychic. If Biden didn't run again, Again, I know everyone's got a lot of chip on their shoulders about Kamala. I still think she's got the inside track to have being the nominee, and Fetterman's the perfect match with her.
Yeah, I think he would beat her.
They would be a commentary ticket.
The ticket, okay. Well, then she could definitely use him. That's for sure. I was going to say, I think he would beat her, but I'm thinking like in terms of a national election, the Democratic primary system, as you know, changes things. And so maybe not. So I can't be so glib about that. Bill, you want to move on or do you have any more Pennsylvania?
Well, you think Democrats made a mistake in the Pennsylvania gubernatorial primaries in boosting Mastriano. Am I saying his name right?
I believe so. Yeah, right. So I don't know if that was what boosted Mastriano or not, like if that was the reason he won. But clearly they were helping him, right? And so Mastriano.
Josh Shapiro, who was the Democratic nominee, didn't have a serious primary to sweat. He spent more money on ads than Mastriano spent himself, and with ads saying, "Ooh, Mastriano's too conservative in Pennsylvania," which is what Claire McCaskill did to Todd Akin back in 2012 and helped Todd Akin become the nominee.
And Democrats did this to help Donald Trump too. And it's a horrible idea. Be careful what you wish for. Be careful what you wish for. And I think that McCaskill thought she was so cute and so clever by doing that.
It worked for her.
It worked for her. But here's, you know, at the presidential level, it's especially dangerous, right? Because in the case of Trump, once it becomes a binary choice, you're putting someone so dangerous within the realm of possibility of, and it worked. I mean, Trump ended up becoming president. Democrats were rooting for him, in some cases actually helping boost Trump. I hate this trend. And look, I don't think necessarily that the Pennsylvania governor is as important as the president, but you know, the Pennsylvania governor is going to appoint the Secretary of State, who will have something to do with certifying.
That's an appointed position in Pennsylvania. It's not elected.
I think it is. You want to fact check me on that, Bill?
I didn't know offhand.
So while you're looking that up, I will just say, I don't think the governor of Pennsylvania is as important as the president. I just think it is a very dangerous and childish trend where you're trying to pick your opponent. I think it's also selfish. You know, you are jeopardizing, you're putting the country at risk of the possibility of having the worst person become the leader under the guise of the notion that that person will be easier for you to beat. I would call it playing with matches. It's playing with fire. It's not good for democracy. It's not a responsible thing to do. And Democrats keep doing it.
Well, I agree with you. There's always a risk involved that the person you boost ends up winning. But you're right about Pennsylvania Secretary of State. That's a point to my governor.
Don't play God. Senate. I would say, like, if you want to root, and by the way, Jimmy Carter's people thought Reagan would be the easiest person to beat. You know, so you don't always know who's going to be. You know, people are not able to discern necessarily who is going to be the easier person to beat. So I would say, if you want to privately root, like, you know, I hope the Red Sox win, you know, the playoffs, so that this team will beat the league. If you want to play that strategic game, you know, as a fan, just cheering someone on, fine. But when you start interfering in the other parties, you know, Operation Chaos, if you start interfering in that, I think that is just playing God. And I think it is naive to think that you can control things.
Well, I don't think it's naive because there are, I mean, we have a case in Missouri where we're clearly McCaskill elevated Akin's profile. You know, he wasn't the biggest name in the race.
Yeah.
And helped elevate her. I don't know if Mastriano needed the name ID boost from Shapiro or not. I mean, we all know that Republicans are perfectly capable of nominating.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. If, I don't know if he would have won that or
these
not.
Days. Yeah. There's a risk in misreading the electorate, in putting people that you think are going to be, you know, instantaneously disqualified in the judgments of voters and be wrong about that.
Yeah.
But I also think there are examples where if you can create a situation where you have a pretty good, if you do know your state well,
yeah,
and say, you know what, this person just can't win. I've been around this place too long. I know what people are like. And we got a guy who's hitting the sweet spot and their guy's not, you know,
I hate it, Bill. Because you don't know your guy could drop dead of a heart attack tomorrow. You can't control the future.
There's no certainty in anything.
This is serious.
Republicans were less insane on the ground, then this wouldn't be a problem. I mean, the fundamental responsibility comes from the Republican voters themselves.
Responsible people, like I voted, as you know, Bill. I voted in the Democratic primary, for Joe Biden. Why did I do that? Because I wanted to mitigate the downside. I didn't say, Bernie Sanders will be easier for Republicans to defeat, therefore let's vote for Bernie Sanders. What I said was, like, I do not want Bernie Sanders to be president. Let's mitigate that by voting for Joe Biden. I mean, I think that's a more responsible way to approach politics instead of let's pick the worst, most dangerous guy and get him as close as possible to power so that I can beat him. That is selfish and irresponsible, and I hate the trend. And Democrats should be hey, if there's a niche to fill, why not be the responsible party that actually cares about the country instead of let's feed the worst impulses? Let's feed, we think the Republican Party is going crazy. Let's expedite that. Let's have more of that. Let's feed the impulses of that. It's very dangerous. And well, by the way, I believe that's what the Lincoln Project, I believe that's where they ended up at some point, which well, I think I agree, is bad.
I agree with you. There, it's a high risk, high reward strategy. But at this point, I feel like the only way we're going to get back to sanity is if there is some kind of reckoning on the Republican side where they realize, you know what, we've let the inmates take over the asylum and we're losing winnable races and we got to get back to reality.
You know, was it Lenin or Marx? I think was it Lenin who said the worse, the better? You know, that's such a, you know, we want things to get worse because they'll only get better after, you know, everything collapses. Some people just want to watch the world burn, Bill.
Well, look, it is possible that what's going on with the Pennsylvania GOP is going to be such a dumpster fire that it might help Democrats keep the Senate. I mean, Democrats need to not net lose anything to keep the Senate.
Yeah. That is got nothing to do with Mastriano. You know,
no, but if the Pennsylvania Republicans are just a train wreck top to bottom on the ticket, I mean, Shapiro, if he's winning going away, presumably that's going to have some coattails for Fetterman. And if Fetterman's a strong candidate in his own right, that might also, you know, that might work in two directions.
I think
if Mastriano's tanking and Republicans are mad at whoever the nominee is in the Senate race, that could just be a total disaster for them.
But I think Democrats could step aside and allow the Republicans to make a mess of it because that's what they're doing. It's a mess in the Senate. And you're right. I mean, there is going to be division and anger. And I think the question is, what matters more, like the atmospherics or campaigns? And usually, to be honest with you, having done a lot of campaigns in my past, atmospherics are more important, but campaigns do matter.
Well, I mean, if Biden's still at 40%, this is going to be a trend the Republicans' way. But in the Senate, you know, it's not the whole country. It's state by state. So you have four democratically held seats in purple states, Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, and what's the fourth one I'm missing? Darn it, there's a fourth. It'll come to me. So if you think it's going to be a Republican wave year, chances are Democrats are going to lose at least one of those four. Then the question becomes, can Democrats offset an expected loss or two with, I mean, right now there's two races of Republican-held seats in Biden won states, and that's Wisconsin and Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Ron Johnson's numbers are horrible. He's got he's in the 30s favorable-wise. Now, I'm not saying it's a slam dunk because Wisconsin's a very polarized state and we still have to see who Democrats nominate. But that's a pretty promising pickup opportunity. And I think Pennsylvania is looking like one too. If Democrats can pick up those two, then they can sacrifice two others. Now, they might still lose all four of those purple state seats and still lose the Senate. But that's why I think Pennsylvania is pretty darn near close to must win.
Before we move on from the campaign, I do want to give a shout out to Senator Tom Tillis from North Carolina, who has made my list preliminarily. He could blow it, but my list of heroes of 2022, he's up there with Vlad, he's up there with Zelensky and Jose Andres at this point in the running for my heroes of the year. Tom Tillis supported, he endorsed the opponent of Madison Cawthorn. He funded the opponent of Madison Cawthorn. And I believe that he was instrumental in defeating Cawthorn. And I think this is what it takes. It takes adult leadership who are willing to take chances, put their money where their mouth is, go all in. And if we're going to stop Trumpism, then it's going to take leaders who have guts, the guts to do it, and then competence to follow through.
So why do you think the GOP establishment was able to do it with Cawthorn, but hasn't shown the will to do it elsewhere?
I think it's a combination of factors, right? So Madison Cawthorn made a huge mistake by trying to change districts and then coming back. Mm-hmm. That obviously hurt him. Madison Cawthorn has been especially egregious and crazy, making him
This is the way it's hard for Democrats to understand. Like, I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene's uniquely egregious. Matt Gaetz is uniquely egregious. Boebert's egregious. Trump's egregious. Like, can you pinpoint what about Cawthorn, like, gave him that extra notch of crazy that actually made Republicans say, okay, this one's too much for us?
Well, let me just finish my list, and then I'll come back to that if you still have that question, right? So Cawthorn tried to leave the district, A, which was a slight, an insult on his constituents. B, he's in the radical camp. There were, pictures of him wearing lingerie, weird stuff like that. I also think it's true that his opponent was a state rep who had apparently done good enough constituent service that he performed well and won his own district, which is vital. So he had a legitimate opponent. Mm-hmm. And then number four, I do think leadership matters. And so I think that Senator Tillis stepping up early and endorsing Cawthorn's opponent and funding Cawthorn's opponent and showing leadership, you put all those things together, Bill, and I think that is a map or a model for how Republicans can, kind of district by district could begin to take back their party.
Now, can I give you one other data point?
Yeah.
Of an optimistic data point about the state of the Republican Party. And I might write up with this. Don't steal this idea from me.
Okay.
In Idaho, actually, there were a number of races where there were like super crazy, like white nationalist adjacent people running that lost, governor, lieutenant governor. And Secretary of State had a race. There's three candidates, and two of them were people that said, the election was stolen from Trump, and one guy that said it was a legitimate election. and that guy won. Now he won with like 43%. So you could say, well, look, if a majority of Republicans wanted to support someone who wanted to back the big lie, so you dodged a bullet, but that's not very heartwarming. But we've had two other Secretary of State primaries so far, with one person saying this is legitimate and one person not. So far, no big lie candidate has won a Secretary of State race. Now, we've only had three. One was Ohio. The weird thing about Ohio is that Trump endorsed the guy who said the race was legitimate. So that's a bit of a head scratcher, but it's what happened. And I'm the third, which one was the third has escaped me for a second. But so what that says to me is not that the Republican Party has ceased to be crazy, because there's plenty of other examples to point to. What it says to me is there isn't much of a grand conspiracy going on to ensure that every Secretary of State position is a Trump lackey poised to steal more elections. If it was, Trump would go to Idaho and say, hey, you get out of the race, make this a binary choice. Hey, Ohio, you said the election, I'm not going to endorse you. I'm going to endorse the other guy who serves my agenda. I mean, the craziness extends to a complete lack of any kind of cohesive strategy going forward, in my estimation. Now, we got another test here in a week, less than a week, in Georgia, because Raffensperger is up for re-election. Again, crowded field.
Yeah.
Not a binary choice between Raffensperger and somebody else. And
so he was written off for dead, Bill. If he wins this thing, it will be proof of resilience, and also that the experts know nothing, because it was a foregone conclusion 6 months ago or whatever, 3 months ago, that he had no chance of reelection.
There's a poll that was taken 3 weeks ago where Raffensperger 31%, Jody Heiss 20%, TJ Hutson 5%, David Bell aisle 4%, undecided 40%. So, you know, that doesn't mean he has anything in the bag, but he was still the front runner. And again, it's a 4-person race, not a 2-person race. So he doesn't need 50% to win. And this is at the same time where Kemp is lapping the field with Purdue, and reportedly Trump's not even going to visit Georgia to help Purdue get over the finish line, let alone the Secretary of State nominee. I'm not even sure if he's endorsed Jody Heiss or somebody else. I should go check. But he's not putting his shoulder into it.
Yeah.
which again just says to me, not that Trump wouldn't like to have people prepared to steal an election for him, but he isn't moving heaven and earth for it, because he just doesn't seem to have the mindset to organize a conspiracy at that level of sophistication.
Bill, we've been talking now for going on 39 minutes. Call it a day, or you want to talk about one more topic?
I was just a little curious. A friend of mine asked me last night, what's up with Matt Lewis and Steve Schmidt?
This has gone viral if you know, people are just bringing it up randomly to you.
So, you know, these are just, you know, regular folks at the local diner asking about Matt Lewis and Steve Schmidt.
Was this a political person who is like, who, you know, follows this closely? Or have I gone like into, you know, am I now in the zeitgeist, Bill?
I think he follows you and me on Twitter.
Okay.
So
I'm huge at Matt. On my Twitter feed, I'm very popular.
Now, I guess I've not been super engaged on this subject. I know that there was a story about Meghan McCain, that her book wasn't selling well. And I think the story was a little bit overhyped because it was about like 1 month of sales and not all total sales. Although I'm sure the book is not selling great. Most books don't sell great. And it's always a sort of mockery.
Hard. Yeah. It is hard to sell books.
Right. I mean, there's...
It ain't easy.
This is a digression, but I think it's fun to mock people who don't sell books when you don't like them. I understand that. But like, the harsh reality is like a very small number of books sell a lot of copies and everything else sells almost nothing.
That's the business model. But here's what's scary, Bill, for those of us who write books and aspire to write books. If Andrew Cuomo can't sell... you know, a couple hundred books just based on being governor of New York, or if Meghan McCain, who has been famous for 15 years, had a super famous dad who was on The View for years, can't just, you know, put out a memoir and just sell, have them flying off the copies. Like, how does anyone do it? You know, it's a tough gig.
I want to stop you for a second, Matt. Okay. Bye. My cat's head is literally in a Ziploc bag. I thought I should not let my cat crawl into a Ziploc bag, but he got out. So anyway, Steve Schmidt took this as an opportunity to tell this story from when she was acting petulantly on the campaign trail and claimed that her mom said, well, I raised my boys well, something like that. And then people were like, Steve Schmidt, what's wrong with you? Why are you airing all this dirty laundry about private conversations about a family? And then he went on to basically validate the allegation that John McCain had an affair, that the New York Times had insinuated during the campaign, and then had like a semi-retraction. So anyway, all this went on. I don't know how you got into it. How did you get in the middle of all this?
The way I got into it is, Bill, I write 150 columns a year. Okay. I write three columns a week. And let's just say an average of 50 weeks a year. You know, I take a couple weeks off. So I write a lot of stuff, and three columns a week, you're looking for what is a topic. Look, and this is my point, is I'm not like waking up, how can I get Steve Schmidt today? Right. It's like, this was in my wheelhouse.
Did you have a dislike of Steve Schmidt before this?
Well, Steve Schmidt and I have. So first of all, Steve Schmidt and I have had some past. Maybe like about a year ago, we had a Twitter fight where he compared me and another conservative writer to Vichy France, or what, you know, is essentially Nazi collaborators. In other words, even though we were never Trump conservatives, we weren't anti-Trump enough for his taste. But instead of just saying that, he again compared us to collaborators, or at least that was my interpretation and everyone else's interpretation of it. So I disclosed that. I mean, I put that in the column that I wrote. But basically, I wrote a column that was about, you know, it starts off talking about how, you know, he's now saying that despite all previous reporting for the last 20 years or 15 years, he's now saying that actually he wasn't the one who vetted and picked Palin, right? That goes against everything. But basically, I start off by pointing out the fact that, you know, I think I just have these old school professional values that if you work on someone's campaign, you don't turn around and tell, you know, undermine them and leak about them or publicly criticize them. And, you know, with McCain, I have no idea. Maybe he did have this long-term relationship. Maybe he did not. It doesn't change my opinion of him. He was a hero in many ways, heroic, and obviously endured horrible things as a POW. I think there ought to be some loyalty to him. I don't think that being mad at his daughter should be the impetus of attacking this great American who, by the way, can't defend himself. So, I mean, I just wrote a column about that. But again, I write three columns a week. I wrote another column about it. The vast majority of the things that I wrote were either quoting, you know, from him, or what the New York Times wrote, or what the Associated Press wrote. It was just a column. And by the way, I'm an opinion columnist. I give my opinion. That's what I do. Maybe I'm right. Maybe I'm wrong. it's my opinion. I'm a conservative opinion columnist. He got super pissed off and really went after me on his Twitter feed. You know, I don't know. He's got at least a million followers, I think. And he went after me personally, mocked the fact that I edited a Sarah Palin book. He put up a picture of me with Alex Jones, Roger Stone, and Jamie Weinstein, implying that I'm like breaking bread with these evil people. And by the way, I do condemn Jamie Weinstein in the harshest terms. I can't believe I was photographed with that guy.
we should be clear, you're obviously joking at the moment, correct?
I'm joking. He's one of my best friends, and he's a great American. But the reason that Steve Schmidt knows about that picture is I published it. I wrote an entire column for the Daily Beast where I condemned Alex Jones and put up a picture of me with them at the Republican convention. So the only reason he had that picture to use against me, it's not like he dug up some super, super secret, embarrassing photo that I didn't want people to see. It's like, I put that out there. Anyway, I think things have subsided. I hope I'm not reigniting, although maybe I should be rooting for it. Bill, I understand why people get into this habit of fighting on Twitter. There is a dopamine release, even if you're being attacked, when you are, and I think enough people dislike him that there were a lot of people who started coming to my defense. Sadly, most of them were texting me and emailing me, not doing it publicly. I heard from some of the top Republican strategists, and I've spent hours on phone calls basically giving therapy to other people who tell me stories about bad experiences they had with him that they don't want to talk about publicly. Mm-hmm. But on Twitter, Bill, I gained a few hundred followers. I mean, out of this, not thousands, but I gained a few hundred Twitter followers. And I'm like, maybe I need to like start more Twitter fights because it is.
Well, that's why people do it.
I mean, people are talking about me now. Hell, people in diners in Northampton, Massachusetts know about me.
No, I didn't listen to this. I just saw the headline. Schmidt did a political interview, podcast interview.
Ryan
said McCain had betrayed him. I'm not clear what the, because I didn't listen to it. I don't know what the betrayal was. Do you know what he's talking about there?
I forget, but there's a lot of stuff, including, and I didn't even get into this in my column, but I think there was an insinuation that some of the people on the McCain campaign were like pro-Russia or something. I didn't even get into that, but it's, I mean, Schmidt told Ryan Lizza that he didn't even vote for Trump.
McCain.
I'm sorry, did I say Trump? Excuse me. Let me mm-hmm. say that again. Mm-hmm. Let me be clear. Schmidt told. Thank you for fact checking me in real time. Schmidt told Politico that he didn't even vote for McCain, the man.
He left the blank, right?
What's that?
He left the blank.
I think so. I don't know.
So I generally agree with you. Like, if you work on a campaign, like you don't go spilling the dirty laundry afterwards. That's not cool. And obviously, if people who do that wouldn't get rehired for other campaigns. I mean, Schmidt's an odd case because he's abandoned the party altogether, so he's not risking
up. Yeah, there is there. A disincentive. There's a personal disincentive against doing it because the next candidate would say, why should I hire this guy? He's going to tell all my dirty laundry, therefore it makes you unhirable. Mm-hmm. But
I'm just curious. Did he have a legitimate reason to feel like McCain burned him first and sort of freed him from such unwritten rules?
If he has one, I don't think he has presented a compelling reason, for his behavior. That's my opinion. But tell us in the comments if you disagree. And let me just also some quick housekeeping here, Bill. If you're still listening to us and watching us on Blogging Heads, then you should subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is actually youtube.com/Matt Lewis. Or if you go to our Twitter feed, which is @DMZ Show, I've linked to the specific section that's the DMZ on that page. But subscribe to us because at some point, sadly, at some point, we will migrate away from the Blogging Heads platform. And if you're watching us there, at some point, you probably won't be seeing us there. So please subscribe to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Matt Lewis. You'll be alerted every time we post these. And also for now, if you're listening to us via audio podcast, and if you prefer, like I love listening to audio podcasts better than watching YouTube videos, to be frank, we're still available at the Blogging Heads, you know, Blogging Heads podcast feed, but at some point we will not be, Bill. And so you want to give us a quick update on how people could listen to us?
Well, I mean, so you can still go to Blogging Heads and see the YouTube there, and we're still on the Blogging Heads podcast feed for now. We have our own podcast channel via Buzzsprout, and I got to do a few things to make sure that that gets put on, you know, the iTunes and the Stitcher and the Spotify and all that sort of stuff. So that's going to happen soon. And I think, but the Buzzsprout link we can push on our Twitter account and Facebook account. Yes.
Yeah. We tweeted it last week. We will tweet it again. So if you want to go ahead and subscribe to that RSS feed or download the podcast and listen to it there, you can. Again, we're still available. You're probably listening to us right now on the Blogging Heads. If you're listening to us now, it's probably happening on the Blogging Heads podcast feed, where we will still be for a certain amount of time. But we're going to go away there probably at some point, sadly. So you should migrate now to our current, to our new platform. You won't miss any shows and you won't forget about us. Also, you should follow us at DMZ Show on Twitter to stay in touch. So we appreciate everyone sticking with us through this transition. And, you know, we're going to keep doing what we do. Bill, we didn't even cover. We got a lot of stuff we left. We could talk for three more hours, I'm sure, but we should probably wrap it up.
All right. Well, till next time, I'll see you back here in the DMZ.
All right. See you guys. Thanks, Bill.